Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Robert Lustig, MD, MSL, is an Emeritus Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and the Institute for Policy Health for Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Lustig's career has focused on the regulation of energy balance by the central nervous system and the pathogenesis of chronic diseases such as type 2 diabetes. He is one of the leaders of the anti-sugar movement to improve global health. Dr. Lustig graduated from MIT in 1976 and received his MD from Cornell University Medical College in 1980. He completed his pediatric residency at St. Louis Children's Hospital in 1983 and his clinical fellowship at UCSF in 1984. From there, he spent 6 years as a research associate in neuroendocrinology at the Rockefeller University. In 2013, he received his master's in studies of law from UC Hastings. He is the author of many academic works and of the popular book, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease, and the Fat Chance Cookbook. Tonight's book, of course, that he'll be speaking of is The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brain. Dr. Lustig is the Chief Scientific Officer at Eat Real, a nonprofit dedicated to reversing childhood obesity and diabetes by impacting the global food supply. Dr. Lustig.
Thank you, Patty. Thank you. Thank you, Patty. Thank all of you for coming. We here at the Commonwealth Club know that you have a choice of hacking lectures to go to, and we sincerely appreciate that you chose this one. Donna Brazile is speaking on the hacking of the American election and her book, Hacks. I wonder where she got that title. At the Marines Memorial Theater. So I do appreciate your coming today. I note many of my current and former colleagues and friends in the audience, and I want to thank all of you. I note my editor for this book, Amy Dietz. So any jokes that you find in the volume, they're hers, okay? Any references to popular culture, because I don't have a blessed clue. Okay, Wolfram Alderson, who is my social media director, and Marcia Cohen, who is my former mentor at, where is she? There she is, at UC Hastings, and several, and Ann Etkin, who is a emeritus professor of neuroscience at Albert Einstein, and she is tonight's bullshit detector. So anything that I say that's wrong, she'll be doing this in real time over realitycheck.com. Okay. So, first of all, I have these disclosures. I did write these books. I don't really consider those disclosures, but I've been told that they're potential conflicts of interest because you write a book. Anyway. I am the chief science officer of Eat Real, which is a nonprofit trying to reverse childhood obesity and diabetes from the bottom up by impacting restaurants. So if you see a green fork in the window of a restaurant, it means that whatever's here at this restaurant can't kill you. And also, I am the chief medical officer of a for-profit called Slendine, where we are trying to impact the metabolic risk associated with processed food because, believe it or not, even though I am totally for real food, processed food's not going away, in case nobody told you. We got to do something about it because we can't afford this, and you'll see why as we go. All right, so I have a very modest agenda tonight. Tonight, I hope and expect to be able to solve the healthcare crisis, solve the Social Security crisis, solve the opioid crisis, solve the depression crisis, and make America happy again. Yeah. I don't know about the last one, but the point of tonight's talk is that the first four are actually four manifestations of the same crisis. And when you understand what that crisis is, then you can actually move forward to solve the others. Because you can't solve a problem based on the problem. You have to solve a problem based on the cause. And if you don't know the cause, you can't solve it. So I'm going to try to impart to you what I think, based on the data, the real problem is. Okay, let's start with the first one. Let's start with healthcare. Anybody recognize this guy? His name is Zeke Emanuel. He's talked here. He is a professor of hematology oncology at the University of Pennsylvania. He is a bioethicist, and he is Rahm Emanuel's brother. And most importantly, he is the architect of Obamacare. And in 2014, 4 years after Obamacare was initiated, he wrote this article in The Atlantic called "Why I Hope to Die at 75. Now, I don't know about you, but I truly hope I'm not dying at 75. I got a lot of work to do. And presumably, you don't really want to die at 75 either, I don't think. But you want to be healthy going to, say, 90 or 95. And to be honest with you, there's no reason you shouldn't be able to. But the data don't go in your favor. And the question is, why is that? So we're going to talk about that. Anyway, he had to justify Obamacare. And it turns out that 50% of all healthcare dollars are spent in the last month of life. So the question is, like, after 75, like, how functional are you? I mean, you know, another way of putting this would be, like, death panels. You know, that's where they got this from. So the question is, did Obamacare deliver? Yes or no? Well, I don't care what you think of Obamacare. It's still the law of the land, for whatever reason. But the question is, did it deliver? President Obama promised us that he could put 32 million sick people onto the rolls. And the way he was going to do it was by providing preventative services. That is, by being able to go see your doctor in advance of you getting super sick so that you wouldn't have to land in the emergency room where the costs are 50 to 100 times greater. That you'd have access to medicines that you needed so that you didn't get your stroke and blow your brains out and end up in the emergency room. That was the idea. But unfortunately, that led instead to this. The government can't make me buy health insurance, and why would I when I'll just go here and you'll pay for it? The question is, was that what happened? Indeed, after Obamacare, we actually saw an uptick in ER visits. Not a downturn, an uptick. And you may remember that in August of 2016, three major insurers left the exchanges, Aetna, Humana, and United, all because they weren't making enough money because Obama capped their profit at 15%. Now, that sounded like a good idea, but they weren't playing. And so people actually weren't getting health care through this phenomenon. So what was the alternative? Well, this was the alternative. This was what Trump Care said. Have diabetes, Trump's budget director says you brought it on yourself. So like the soup Nazi, no health care for you. Here's the problem. There are not one, but rather two inconvenient truths that have not been dealt with. The first, actually, I take it back. It's for this one first. There is no medicalized prevention for chronic metabolic disease. There's just long-term treatment. And I will show you the data because I just stuck this slide in 1 hour ago because this paper just came out 3 days ago, and it's a meta-analysis of preventative studies for diabetes, either lifestyle on the left or medicines on the right. And if you look at it, you know, you're looking at the diamond, and you're looking to see if it crosses one. So they are statistically significant, but when you actually look at the number needed to treat, 25. So you have to put 25 people through a diabetes prevention program in order to be able to stop one case of diabetes. That's not very good. And since these studies cost about $6,000 a patient, and we have 40% of America that is pre-diabetic, And you're going to get one patient saved for every 25 treated or prevented. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And that's the inconvenient truth. It doesn't work. The second problem, you can't fix healthcare until you fix health, and you can't fix health until you fix diet. And sadly, you can't fix diet until you know what the hell is wrong with it. And we've been operating on a false premise for a long time. Here's an example of the false premise. Everybody remember this Time magazine cover? And now the bad news, right? Okay. So the question was this true? We based a whole lot on it. Well, we put this into process. We started this thing called the low-fat diet, and every commodity, every product in the store had a regular version and a low-fat version, and 17 years later, this is what we got instead. And today, it's not 6 million kids seriously overweight, it's 25. So, the question is, what happened? Well, what happened is on this slide. Now, who here watches football? Oh, come on, more of you watch football than that. Come on, be honest. Okay. This is Coca-Cola's Coming Together campaign from 2013. It was on every football game. Okay, two-minute video. You can watch it on YouTube. Not right now, but here's what it said. This is a direct quote from that video. Beating obesity will take action by all of us based on one simple common sense fact. All calories count, no matter where they come from, including Coca-Cola and everything else with calories. So, you can get your calories from carrots, or you can get your calories from cheesecake, or you can get your calories from Coca-Cola, or you can get your calories from kumquats. Doesn't matter. Because the first law of thermodynamics is in play. Therefore, it's about energy balance. Therefore, it's about calories in, calories out. Therefore, it's about two behaviors, gluttony and sloth. Therefore, if you're fat, it's your fault. Therefore, any calorie can be part of a balanced diet. Therefore, don't pick on our calories. Go pick on somebody else's calories. All of those come from this single mantra that calories are fungible. That doesn't matter where they come from. And after all, it's common sense. Well, I don't believe in common sense. I believe in science. I believe in data. At UCSF, we have a motto. In God we trust, everyone else has to produce the data. Which is why we're UCSF. Okay? Well, turns out the data say something else entirely. But who has been saying this? Well, let's look who's been saying this. These are all the people who've been saying this. Okay? The 10 conglomerates there, okay, they control 90% of the U.S. food supply, and they're the ones who've been saying it. It's about calories. It's about obesity. You get fat, you get sick. Is that true? Well, here is a scattergram of all the countries in the world. Obesity prevalence here on the x-axis, diabetes prevalence here on the y-axis. And you would look at this graph and you would say, well, Dr. Lustig, very clearly, there's a correlation. And indeed, there is. And there it is right there. There is a correlation. But correlation is not concordance. Because there are countries that are obese without being diabetic, such as Iceland, Mongolia, Micronesia. And there are countries that are diabetic without being obese, such as India, Pakistan, and China. India and China today have an 11% diabetes prevalence. We, the fattest nation on earth, only have a 9.4% diabetes prevalence. If diabetes is the cause, I mean, if obesity is the cause, then how come they're thin and they have more diabetes than us? Problem number one. Problem number two. Obesity is increasing worldwide at the rate of 1% per year, yet diabetes is increasing worldwide at the rate of 4% per year. If diabetes is just a subset of the larger subgroup of obese persons, how can you explain that? Well, you can't, because it ain't true. And third, this is the secular trend in rate of diabetes prevalence On the left side, total cases, and on the right side, stratified by weight. So obese, overweight, normal weight. Everybody got that? And what you can see in the right side is that there's been a 25% increase in the rate of diabetes amongst the obese, but there's also been a 25% increase in normal weight people as well. If obesity is the cause, then how come the normal weight people are getting as diabetic as the obese are? Doesn't make sense. So this is the most important thing I'm going to try to teach you tonight. Okay? And if you don't get this, nothing else matters. This is a Venn diagram of the entire U.S. population. 240 million adults total. 30% obese, BMI over 30. 70% normal weight, BMI under 30. Two mutually exclusive circles. And everyone in this room is in one of the two circles. Now, the standard mantra from the doctors and the dietitians and the Institute of Medicine and the NIH and the Surgeon General and the White House and Congress and the food industry is the following. 80% of those obese people, they're metabolically ill. They get type 2 diabetes. They get hypertension. They get lipid problems. They get cardiovascular disease. They get cancer. They get dementia. These 80% of 30%, these 57 million people right here, it's all their fault. It's all their fault because they're fat and they're sick and they're sick because they're fat. And if they would only just diet and exercise, we could solve this problem. That's what they say. Except the meta-analyses say otherwise, don't they? Here's the problem. 20% of the obese population is actually metabolically healthy. We have a name for them, MHO, metabolically healthy obese. We study them to try to figure out how come they didn't get sick. They will live a completely normal life, die at a completely normal age, not cost the taxpayer a dime. They're just fat. Conversely, 40% of the normal weight population have the exact same diseases as do the obese. They get type 2 diabetes, hypertension, lipid problems, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia. They get them too. Now, they get them at a lower prevalence, no argument, 40% versus 80%. I'm not suggesting obesity is like good. Increase, it's a risk factor. No argument there. I'm on board with that. But if normal weight people get it too, how can it be about behavior? And when you do the math, turns out there are more thin sick people than there are fat sick people. But the thin sick people are the ones who are blaming the fat sick people. And when you do the math on the two of them together, it's more than half the U.S. population, which is why Obamacare can't work. Everybody got that? And I'll prove it to you. So here we have, any radiologists in the room? Good. Okay. Now, here are CT scans through the abdomens of two equally weighted people. Notice trunk fat 12.8. Okay? Both. One's healthy, one's sick. Which one's sick, A or B? Most people say B. Right? Yeah. A, he's just got big love handles. Over here, subcutaneous fat, big butt fat, if you will. Okay? Cosmetically, not so great. But metabolically, eh. This guy down here, he's got fat all around his organs. He's got visceral fat. Okay? And we know that the visceral fat, the big belly fat, is much more dangerous than the big butt fat. But it turns out it's not even that. Because here is what we call an MRI fat fraction map. So here's an obese person. Notice the love handles on the side, right? But I want you to take a look at this guy's liver right there. Notice nice and dark. That's good. Very little fat in it, 2.6%. This is a metabolically healthy obese, MHO. There's nothing wrong with this guy. Now, this is what you would normally expect to see. This is a fat guy. And take a look at his liver. You know, ground glass appearance, lots of fat. Okay, this guy's got metabolic syndrome. This guy's got obesity plus all those diseases we talked about. Okay, he's costing the system money. Now, over here, we got a thin guy. Notice, not too much on the way love handles. But take a look at his liver, 23% liver fat. This guy's just as sick as this guy because it's not the fat you can see. It's the fat you can't. And the question is, what about you? We have a name for this. I actually forgot to mention it on the first slide. I apologize. On the top there, in the left, TOFI, T-O-F-I. Thin on the outside, fat on the inside. Real medical terms, swear to God, 1,500 midline citations. Coined by Dr. Jimmy Bell, a neuroimager at University College London. TOFI. So the question is, are you a TOFI? And how would you know? How would your doctor know? And if you were, what would you do about it? How would you fix it? Would you know? That's the question. So it turns out, everyone thought this was all about dietary fat. Fat makes you fat. That was the idea. Well, it turns out that the American Heart Association, who was one of the main promulgators of this fat makes you fat idea back in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, they have walked it back. Okay? And I'm proud to be a member of the American Heart Association. I was actually on the board of directors of the Bay Area American Heart Association. The reason is because they got it. When you make a mistake, you admit the mistake, you right the ship. This is their admission of the mistake. And it was done by Ron Kraus, who is actually across the way at Children's Research Institute, at Children's Oakland Research Institute. Here's the most amazing thing. Okay, this is an international investment bank, Credit Suisse. Okay, like their job is to make money. That's all they care about. Okay, but they don't have any like scientific or medical bias. All they do is look at the data. And they came out with this report, and I had, swear to God, I had nothing to do with this report, okay? But they came out with this report in 2016, Fat, the New Health Paradigm, and here's what they said. A high intake of omega-6 fats, vegetable oils, has not been proven as beneficial for our health, and trans fats have been shown to have negative health effects. The higher intake of vegetable oils and the increase in carbohydrate consumption in the last 30 to 40 years are the two leading factors behind the high rates of obesity and metabolic syndrome in the United States. Saturated and monounsaturated fats are not. Totally, completely, 100% agree. Couldn't agree more. With a bank! But if you go ask a doctor, what do they say? They say something else entirely, right? So the question is, how do you turn the ship around when so many people are on board going in one direction? How do you all of a sudden make them reverse course? And it's pretty hard to do, I will tell you. I've been trying to do it now for a couple of years. Pretty tough to do. Okay. So these guys have been trying to do it. So Asim Malhotra, who's one of my colleagues and good friends, Rita Redberg, who is a UCSF physician and also editor-in-chief of JAMA Internal Medicine, not exactly a lightweight, and Pascal Meyer, who is the editor-in-chief of BMJ Open Heart, also not a lightweight, okay, came out with this editorial. Saturated fat does not clog the arteries. Coronary heart disease is a chronic inflammatory condition, the risk of which can be effectively reduced from healthy lifestyle interventions. And what they say is this thing called insulin resistance is the big problem. And the thing that does it is excess sugar, fructose, the sweet molecule of sugar, which we're going to talk a lot about in a minute, and refined carbohydrates. That is the driver. And that's exactly what Credit Suisse said, too. In fact, we just published our own editorial in the Pharmaceutical Journal. The cholesterol and calorie hypotheses are both dead. It is time to focus on the real culprit, insulin resistance. So the question is, okay, where's the data? Well, here's the data. So we've published three papers in the last 2 years in good places. Okay, what we did was we took 43 kids out of our obesity clinic at UCSF, the one I was in charge of, the weight assessment for Teen and Child Health Clinic, Latino and African American, so lower socioeconomic status kids, eating, you know, usual diet for kids. You can imagine what that is, right? And what we did was we figured out what they were eating at home. We studied them on their home diet, and then we catered their meals for the next 9 days to provide the exact same calories, the exact same fat, the exact same protein, and the exact same carbohydrate. But within carbohydrate, we took the sugar out and we put the starch in. We did a starch for sugar exchange. We took their dietary sugar consumption from 28% of calories down to 10%. Now, that's a change of 350 to 400 calories per kid. Now, if you don't replace that, kids would lose weight. And then if the kids got better, people say, well, of course they got better. They lost weight. So we had to give them something that was equivalent in calories, starch. Starch and sugar, same number of calories, 4.2 calories per gram. Okay, so in the vernacular, we took the pastries out, we put the bagels in. We took the sweetened yogurt out, we put the baked potato chips in. We took the chicken teriyaki out, we put the turkey hot dogs in. Everybody got it? Okay, we didn't give them good food, we gave them crappy food, okay? We gave them processed food. We gave them kid food. Food kids would eat, but it was no added sugar food. Okay? I'm not going to bore you with all the, you know, graphs. I'm just going to show you what we did. So these kids had lots of liver fat, and they were making lots of triglyceride, VLDL. And we did 9 days of sugar restriction, and we studied them again. And their, whoops, what happened to their fat? There it is. Their liver fat went down. Their de novo lipogenesis, turning sugar to fat, went down. Okay, their VLDL, their triglycerides went down, and their blood pressure went down, and their insulin kinetics went up. They got better. Okay, they stopped being insulin resistant, and their beta cells could rest. We actually reversed their metabolic syndrome in 10 days with no change in calories and no change in weight. Okay, and we also measured their, oops, got to find it. Where'd it go? There it is. We measured their different fat depots. Remember, it's big butt fat, big belly fat, big liver fat. So here's their big butt fat, no change, because we didn't let them lose weight. We gave them extra calories so that they wouldn't lose weight. Here's their visceral or big belly fat, down 7%. That's good. But here's their liver fat. Went down 22% because we took the substrate away that was making the liver fat. And it's that liver fat that's driving all that type 2 diabetes out there. It is the single biggest risk factor for the development of type 2 diabetes. And 40% of America now has non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, a disease we'd never heard of before 1980, and now 40% of the population has it, and 30% of obese kids. Okay, that's the problem. And it turns out all of this low-fat stuff was a fraud, a big lie. And we have the proof. We have the paper trail. This is a paper that my colleagues at UCSF, Kristen Carnes, Laura Schmidt, Stan Glantz wrote. Remember Stan, you know, Stan, he's the anti-tobacco guy, the guy who basically told us what was going on with tobacco and how they were pulling the wool over our eyes. Well, this is the sugar documents. Instead of the tobacco documents, we have the sugar documents. And they say that the Sugar Research Foundation was paying off scientists. In fact, two Harvard School of Public Health scientists to publish two literature reviews in the New England Journal of Medicine, which singled out fat and cholesterol as the dietary causes of coronary disease and downplayed the evidence that sucrose consumption was also a risk factor. The Sugar Research Foundation set the review's objectives, contributed articles for inclusion, and received drafts, and the funding was never disclosed. You've been hacked. The first of many. You've been hacked. You didn't know you'd been hacked. And the question is, how much damage did this hack do? Like bringing healthcare to its knees? Worldwide because of this hack? So here's what's been going on. So our ancestors, getting fruits and vegetables and occasional honey, you know, consumed about 4 pounds of sugar per year. And here's the growth of the sugar industry, you know, CNH, Domino, you know, Louisiana, Texas, Hawaii, you know, and then it reached stabilization where price equaled demand. And here's the rationing of World War II right there, okay? And here's stabilization again. And then here's the introduction of processed food because we took the fat out and you had to do something to make the food palatable because when you take the fat out of food, it tastes like crap. It tastes like cardboard. Okay? So what they do, they added sugar. And that was the, and then they also added high fructose corn syrup because it was cheaper. And so that's what happened. And here's what happened Oh, sorry. I should have looked. This is what happened to healthcare costs at that point. They skyrocketed because of our change to processed food.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So here's the math. The food industry grosses $1.4 trillion a year. This is a big number, okay? And of that, $657 billion is gross profit. So they have a gross profit margin of 45%. The next highest industry is Big Pharma at 18%. 45%, 18%. Now, we are talking about how the pharma industry is getting away with murder, right? What do you think the food industry is getting away with? 45%? Really? Okay. Now, healthcare costs in the United States total $3.2 trillion. And of that $3.2 trillion, 75% is chronic metabolic disease. And 75% of that would be preventable if we could go back to 1970 rates. So when you do the math on 75% of 75% of $3.2 trillion, that means that $1.8 trillion a year is going down a rat hole. And that is why healthcare is on its knees. That is why Obamacare can't work. That is why you can't afford your medicines. That is why everything that is going wrong economically in this country. If we had $1.8 trillion in our back pocket, you think we could solve healthcare? You think we could solve the budget crisis? You think we would need any of this stuff that's going on today if we could recoup even a fraction of that? Okay, we lose triple what the food industry makes, and they don't want to change it because at 45% gross profit margin, that is their friggin' gravy train. Okay, this is unsustainable. You can't lose more than they make. Okay, and that's why Medicare is going broke, and that's why Obamacare or Trump care or any other care ain't ever going to fix it. Everybody got that? So we looked at how much money could the United States save if we could drop our sugar consumption by 20% here in blue or 50% here in red. 20% would be like a tax, and 50% is if we actually adhered to the USDA guidelines. Okay, those were the two things we chose. Here's fatty liver disease, here's heart disease, type 2 diabetes, overweight, obesity. This is actually the prevalence data, and I'll show you the money data in a minute. Now, we've solved the healthcare crisis. Let's move on to Social Security. Now, you know that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, right? You know that, right? I mean, you know, like, that's not new. Okay. The only difference between Social Security and Bernie Madoff is with Social Security, maybe you'll see it. Maybe you won't. Right? Okay? But, you know, Social Security is going to be broke by the year 2029. And here's the reason. Because in order for a Ponzi scheme to work, you need the young, healthy people down here at the bottom to pay in so that the old, infirm people up here at the top can take out. That's the idea, right? But here's what's happening today, because the entire bottom of the pyramid is gone, because those young, healthy people are not paying in, because they're all on disability. In fact, they're taking out because some of them are on dialysis. And they can't work, and they're actually taken out. And when that happens, then the entire pyramid crumbles. In fact, here are the latest data from the Congressional Budget Office. The trust fund will be depleted by the year 2029, and here's what's going to happen right there. Okay, and the problem is I'm going to be 72 in the year 2029, and I want my friggin' Medicare and Social Security. And presumably you do too. Because you worked hard for it, you paid into it, and you know what? It ain't going to be there because of this. Because of this. Now, I'm not the only one bellyaching. I am not the only one who's raising hell about this. Here's another example of somebody who looked at this with a clear eye. Morgan Stanley, another international global investment bank who only cares about money, right? That's their job, to make money. They only make money when their clients make money. And so here they've modeled from 2015 going to 2035, the next 20 years, what economic productivity and growth will be in the United States based on a low sugar case, which we don't have in blue, versus a high sugar case, which we do have here in gold. And you'll notice that by the year 2035, we will reach a 0.0% economic growth. Now, who is that good for? Is it even good for the food industry? It's not good for anybody. But that's where we're headed. So this volume was called The Bittersweet Aftertaste of Sugar. Okay, and again, I had nothing to do with this. They came up with this stuff on their own. So if the banks are saying this, you know there's a problem. Okay, so much so that Credit Suisse, again, extended, stuck their neck out in September of 2013 with this volume, Sugar Consumption at Crossroads, and they said this: we believe higher taxation on sugary food and drinks would be the best option to reduce sugar intake and help them fund the fast-growing healthcare costs associated with type 2 diabetes and obesity. An international investment bank calling for taxation. Now, how effed up is that? I mean, think about it. Who ever heard of such a thing? But they got it right. Well, in fact, I am very proud of all of you because you voted for a soda tax back in 2014. Well done. Okay? But, you know, like, we get it. You know, Oakland did it. Albany did it. Even Philadelphia voted a soda tax, right? Now, they didn't use health as the reason. They used pre-K education as their reason. But did you see what happened in Chicago? They rescinded it. They passed it, and then they rescinded it before they even instituted it. You know why? American Beverage Association paid off the entire legislature. This is the hook. This is their juggernaut. This is their secret weapon. This is their stealth nutrient, because it's not a nutrient. It is the thing that drives the machine. And you know what? I'm not even the only one who says that. Look at this cover. This is National Geographic. Sugar. Why we can't resist it. Indeed, we can't. In fact, sugar is addictive. It activates the same pathway in the brain as does cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol. Does the exact same thing. And I will show you the data that demonstrates that that's the case. Now, you know we have a drug crisis in this country, don't you? In fact, President Trump has declared it a public health emergency, but requested no funds. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions said the way we're going to deal with this is just what Nancy Reagan said, just say no. So the question is, did just say no work? Do you think just say no could work? Do you think there's any way for just say no to work? But this is what we've got. So we have the recognition of a crisis and absolutely no idea how to deal with it. The question is, why do we have this opioid crisis? Why did it happen? And there are lots of reasons, but I'm going to give you the real reason. Okay? And it's not even me who's going to give it to you. I'm going to let somebody else do the talking. Okay? And you're going to believe it. Ready?
I couldn't get through a day without doing something to alter my consciousness.
And it started with heroin, the addiction.
It started with sugar.
Sugar?
Oh, yeah. When I was 5, 6 years old, I was cramming sugar down my throat as fast as I could get it down. Sweets, you know, sugar on bread and butter. I became addicted to sugar because it changed the way I felt.
Sugar is a gateway drug. It's the truth. It is. And what are we giving our six-month-olds? Processed baby food. What's in processed baby food? Look at the second ingredient. And what's in breast milk? Turns out, same thing, if the mother drank a Coke before. And you know what? They may even get indoctrinated before they're born. There's data in animals now that even happens before they're born. We're never going to fix this. Think about it. So the question is there such a thing as processed food addiction? Okay. Well, there are a whole bunch of people who say so, some of whom have spoken on this very dais. There's a textbook on the issue. So the question is, what has happened to us? What has happened to our society? Not just because of sugar, but because of this whole question of hedonic pleasures. That's the issue. Everybody recognize this document? Ever seen it before? Ever read it? There's only one clause everyone in the world knows, and it is this one. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So my question to you is, like Ed Koch would say, how are we doing? How are we doing for life? Turns out, not so good. Because here's the life expectancy in the United States leveling out in the slowest recorded. In fact, it's actually gone down. While everybody else, Niger, Ethiopia, Peru, Portugal, have all been catching up. We are not. In fact, heart disease has gone down. In replacement, we have diabetes instead. Okay? And we can treat with statins, but, you know, if you get diabetes, it's not like it's going to be much difference. So Angus Deaton, Nobel Prize-winning economist, and his wife, Ann Case, looked at these data and said, okay, who's dying? So here are all these other countries. Here are the U.S. Hispanics here in dark blue. And here are the U.S. whites. It's the U.S. whites who are going up, not the people you'd think, not the teenagers. It's the older people. Look, this is cause of death in whites, ages 45 to 54, poisonings and suicides. Poisonings and suicides in 45 to 50-year-old white people. You've been hearing about this. Ohio is, you know, like ground zero for this. The question is, what's going on? So here's illicit drug use in the United States over the last several years going up. Here's illicit drug use in older adults. OxyContin, really, really good stuff, huh? Here's deaths from heroin and fentanyl going up. Here's deaths from cocaine going up. Here's death from benzodiazepines for all those people who can't sleep going up. And this one's particularly disturbing. Alcohol use. Not in men so much, but in women. An 83.7% increase in alcohol abuse amongst women. And what age? Older women. Older women. Going up in everybody, but in older women. Why are all you old women getting drunk? Your kids are out of the house, or maybe they're not. I don't know. So, life, not so good. All right, let's take the next one. How about liberty? Anybody familiar with this project at Harvard? Raj Chetty, brilliant economist, runs the Equality of Opportunity Project. And here's the data on how well kids do in different counties across the country based on where they were born, adjusting for everything else. Adjusting for parental income, adjusting for education, adjusting for race, adjusting for socioeconomic status, adjusting for everything. And you can see there's a lot of red. Not doing so hot. And so you'd say, well, it's the Southeast. We live over here. Yeah. No, not so much. Take a look here. This is New York City. Okay. So here's the Bronx over here. Okay. Everybody oriented? Here's Bergen County, New Jersey over here, okay, just across the Hudson River. George Washington Bridge over there, right? You know, the one Chris Christie sabotaged, that one. Okay. All right. So this is for parents at the 25th percentile on the economic scale. So these are relatively poor people. If you were born in the Bronx, you have a 10.89% lower salary than your parents did. Whereas if you were born in Bergen, you had a 13.77% greater salary than your parents did, adjusting for everything else. You say, well, wait a second, that's just for the poor people. So the poor people are just staying poor, right? No. Well, here's the richer people, 75th percentile. Guess what? Still there. It's across the board. We have made ghettos of our own construction. And I don't care if they're in the barrio or they're in St. Francis would. They are ghettos nonetheless. And the question is that liberty? Not really. In fact, if you look, these are again, unrelated to anything else, just where you were born, here are the top 10 counties to be from. Okay, and here are the bottom 10 counties to be from, unrelated to anything else. So, the moral of this slide is, whatever you do, don't move to Baltimore. So I would say liberty, not so good. And finally, the pursuit of happiness. How are we doing on that one? So here are children's hospital admissions with the diagnosis of suicidal ideation or self-harm over the last 7 years. And you can see going up, especially in, of course, the pubertal kids, and encounters in the clinic with suicidal ideation or self-harm tripling in our teenagers. Now, this is particularly worrisome for two reasons. This is ages 10 to 14, okay? So young adolescents. And what you'll notice is that motor vehicle accidents, deaths from motor vehicle accidents have gone down. And you'd say, that's good, right? But suicides have gone up. And in fact, suicides are now higher than motor vehicle accidents. And the question is, why did motor vehicle accidents go down? Because they're all home playing the friggin' video games. They're not going anywhere. Which is why they're depressed and suiciding. Duh. In fact, antidepressant use is going up continuously. So we don't just have an opioid crisis, we have a depression crisis. And it's not even just us, it's the whole world. 4.4% of the entire globe has now been diagnosed with clinical depression, an 18.5% increase in prevalence over a decade, World Health Organization says. So we have a healthcare crisis. We have a Social Security crisis. We have an opioid crisis. We have a depression crisis. No, we don't. We have one crisis. And the crisis is we've been hacked. We've been hacked. What's the hack? I would argue that the hack has been the systematic confusion and conflation of two words, two terms, two positive emotions. Two things we look for and strive for, pleasure and happiness. Now, who here can tell me the difference between pleasure and happiness? Anyone? Please, in the back. Okay, pleasure is short-lived, happiness is long-lived. That's number one. Six more to go. Go ahead. That's what?
Pleasure is external.
External. Happiness is internal? Well, pleasure is internal too. If you experience it internally, you don't experience it externally, huh? So pleasure is visceral, you feel it in your body. Happiness is ethereal, you feel it above the neck. Is that fair? Okay, two, five more. Come on. Come on, you guys are for the Commonwealth Club. Come on. Brain power, let's go. Yeah. That's number one. Try another one. All right, I'll do it for you. Pleasure is taking, happiness is giving. Pleasure is experienced alone. Happiness is usually experienced in social groups. Pleasure is achievable with substances. Happiness is not achievable with substances. The extremes of pleasure, whether it be substances or behaviors. So substances like cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar, or behaviors. Shopping, gambling, video games, social media, porn. In the extreme, all lead to addiction. There's an addiction for every one of those. But you can't be addicted to too much happiness. And finally, most importantly, pleasure is dopamine and happiness is serotonin. Two different biochemicals, two different areas of the brain, two different sets of receptors, two different regulatory pathways. So you say, like, who cares? Why do we care? Well, here's why. Turns out these two biochemicals are very different. Because dopamine is excitatory. It's an excitatory neurotransmitter. It makes the next neuron fire. So there's this area of your brain called the reward center, known as the nucleus accumbens. And it's where the dopamine terminals are. The actual cell bodies are further down. I will show you in a minute. Okay, but they go to the nucleus accumbens and they activate, they excite, they make the next neuron fire. Now, neurons like to be stimulated. They like to be excited because, you know, that's how you transduce emotion. But neurons like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. Chronic overstimulation of any neuron leads to neuronal cell death. And we know that because kids with seizure disorders lose neurons because of the chronic constant seizures. Okay? So excitatory neurotransmitters are good in small doses, not in long-term big doses. Okay? Now, because of that, the second neuron, the one that's being stimulated, called the postsynaptic neuron, it has a fail-safe. It has a plan B. It has a self-defense mechanism. What it does is it down-regulates the number of receptors so that the neuron can't be stimulated quite as severely. So what does this mean in human terms? It means, well, you get a hit, you get a rush, receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush because there are fewer receptors, and then the receptors go down, and then a bigger hit, until finally get a huge hit to get nothing. That's called tolerance. And then when the neurons start to die, that's called addiction. Everybody got that? And we know that because we have measurements. We have fMRIs where we can actually look at the dopamine receptors in the nucleus accumbens. So here's a control brain, and here's a cocaine brain. Okay, and the red says lots of receptors. Notice, not so many in the cocaine brain because they've been downregulated. Well, here's a control brain. Here's an obese brain. See the same thing. Same thing. Okay. Conversely, serotonin, this other biochemical, this other neurotransmitter, is inhibitory. It doesn't activate the next neuron. It actually puts it to rest. So it won't kill that neuron. So you don't have to downregulate your receptor if you're not going to kill it. Get it? So you can't overdose on too much happiness. It won't let you, which is good, kind of, sort of. Okay? So here's the pathway. Here's the ventral tegmental area where the dopamine neurons start. Here's the nucleus accumbens, which is the reward center. And it also innervates this area over here called the prefrontal cortex. Anybody ever heard of that one before? It's right here, right behind your forehead, above your eyes. Okay, it is the Jiminy Cricket of your brain. It is the executive function center of your brain. It is the part of your brain that tells you not to do stupid things. Everybody got it? Adolescents do stupid things. And the reason is because their prefrontal cortex is not completely mature. And it takes a while for it to mature. And it's in the process of maturing through adolescence, which is kind of bad. But it's also why the Army drafts 18-year-olds. Because they don't know the difference. And don't think they don't. Now here's serotonin. It starts in a different place called the dorsal raphe nucleus. Okay, also innervates the prefrontal cortex. Actually innervates the entire brain. And there are 14 different receptors for serotonin, doing different things in different places. The one that we care about is called the 1A receptor. Okay? And it's doing all sorts of stuff, but it's the one that basically drives contentment by inhibiting, by bringing you down a little bit. Okay? And finally, there's this last pathway called the stress, fear, memory pathway. And you've all heard about this one. Okay? The amygdala is this walnut-shaped nucleus on either side of your head. And it's the fear center. It's the one that goes great guns when you walk down a deserted street at 3 a.m. Okay? The hippocampus over here is the memory center. So that's where the memory of when you put your hand on a hot stove when you were 3 years old, that's where that one's stored. Okay? And these are in reciprocal connection with each other. Okay? So when one's working, the other one's not, and vice versa. Okay? And the goal is to try to get your hippocampus to keep your amygdala under control. And your prefrontal cortex is doing the same thing. It's basically trying to calm it down. Okay, it's trying to, like I said, not do stupid things. And you got your hypothalamus over here, which is where you feel most of your emotions and where all hormones are released. And so it tells your adrenal glands to make cortisol, and cortisol is your stress hormone. The problem with cortisol is it puts the prefrontal cortex to sleep. It basically puts it into suspended animation. Cortisol inactivates your inhibitory center. The more stress, the more your dopamine will be able to, shall we say, flourish, which is not a good thing. So the more stress we add to our lives, the worse things get. So here's sort of the pathway, if you will. Here's what we've done, okay? And there are reasons we've done it, and there are reasons why it's been done to us. Technology, processed food, sugar, lack of sleep, drugs. Every single one of these ups your dopamine. And in the process, you lower your dopamine receptor, and that's a vicious cycle that leads to tolerance. Then throw some stress on, and that basically puts you over the edge to addiction. So basically, reward plus stress gets you to addiction. On the other side, we have all of these things lowering serotonin through the diseases that we've been talking about, the metabolic syndrome diseases, and it turns out cortisol, stress, lowers the receptor for serotonin, so you can't even transduce that happiness or the contentment signal. And so you throw unhappiness on top of stress, and you end up with depression. So addiction and depression are actually two sides of the same coin. Some may get one, some may get the other, some may get both, but ultimately, the reason for the rise is right here in this big black box. So let me summarize for you what we've said. Addiction is excessive reward because of too much dopamine, which down-regulates dopamine receptors, throw some stress on, and you end up with diminution of pleasure. Depression, deficient contentment, not enough serotonin, metabolic syndrome, stress and cortisol reduces those receptors, and you end up with diminution of happiness. So, who did this to us? How about industry? It's been willful. It's been well orchestrated. Now, I will tell you, it is a plot, not a conspiracy. And the reason it's not a conspiracy is because industry actors have no interest in sharing their information with other industry actors. They've all figured this all out by themselves. Okay? So it's a plot, not a conspiracy, because there's no collusion. No collusion! Okay? But it's been engineered specifically with a profit motive. Here's an example. Everybody familiar with this one? Yeah? Okay. Longest running campaign in the company's history, 10 years. Okay. Any happiness in that bottle? Whole lot of pleasure, sugar and caffeine. Any pleasure? Any happiness? Not really. How about this one? The road to your happy place is paved with raisins and flakes and pavement. So, basically the inference is it's your fault. Okay. So I want you to take a look at those raisins. Are those raisins? Yes. Are those the raisins in Raisin Bran? No. There are the raisins in Raisin Bran. Okay? 18 grams of sugar. If you actually isolate the raisins and count them, which I did, it's worth 8 grams of sugar. So that means that 10 grams of sugar is the white sugar coating on each of the raisins to make it sweeter so that you will eat them. And if you want Raisin Bran crunch, you get up to 29 grams of sugar, brown sugar, syrup. Sugar is number 2, corn syrup, honey, whatever, you know. I mean, like, all right, how about Nestle? Okay, so well-being. This is their wellness slide, okay? Happiness and health are intimately linked together. The healthier you are, the happier you'll be, and vice versa. I can agree with that. And they say happiness comes from spending time with loved ones, fostering relationships, or learning to cope with stress or depression. I totally agree, except for one thing. Where is it? There it is. Nestle wants to sell you both sugary snacks and diabetes pills. They're getting into the drug business so they can cause your disease and treat it at the same time. How's that? Okay. Okay. And they're giving Nestle products to promotores in Brazil who are going around to poor neighborhoods selling this stuff, and they think they're making money and doing right by their populace. How about the Happy Meal? Anything happy about that? Okay. The good news is fewer Happy Meals sold. The bad news is kids are ordering from the dollar menu instead. How about happy hour? It's 5 o'clock somewhere. You know where it's 5 o'clock? It's 5 o'clock at 10 o'clock on the East Coast every single morning when Hoda and Kathy Lee have the Today Show happy hour, which is probably why the alcohol rate has gone up 83.7% in older women. What we don't know yet is if that's what they're watching. The problem with this is it's particularly egregious because Hoda has breast cancer. And alcohol is a driver of breast cancer recurrence and progression. Not so good. And finally, perhaps the most pernicious of all, I love this one, and you will probably be dancing in your seats with this one. It's a video. You'll enjoy. Clap along if you know what happiness is to you. Clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do. Hey, go! Bring me down, can't none. One candy bar. Bring me down. Second candy bar. Not done. Bring me down, can't none. Bring me down. I said, tell you now. Bring me down, can't none. Bring me down. The love is too high. Bring me down, can't none. Bring me down. I said, yeah, bring me down. If you're drinking Red Bull and eating 2 candy bars and a bag of potato chips in South Central LA at midnight, you are not happy. So let's add some stress to the reward. I know. I got it, Patty. I got it. Okay. Everybody familiar with this? They're having fun. Yeah. Are you having fun?
Yeah.
All right. Good. All right. Okay. Everybody familiar with this? All right. You know, like, will you be ready? How about a little more stress? Oh. And you wanted to cut me off. My best joke. Sleep deprivation, right? Everybody familiar with that. Technology, all the reasons, right? In fact, Gene Twenge, a sociologist at UC San Diego, said, has smartphones destroyed a generation? Indeed, in actually starting to look that way. In fact, this has all been engineered very specifically, and I can prove it to you. So this is from a book from Nir Eyal, who is an internet entrepreneur in the Valley, okay? Wrote a book called Hooked, How to Perfect Habit-Forming Products. And there are 4 parts to the model. The trigger, an itch, if you will, like your email's going off in your pocket, okay? Because you know that your iPhone is a slot machine, right? In your pocket, okay? Then the action, which is the scratch, which, you know, like checking your email, you know, it's got to be socially acceptable, you know. Checking your email currently is socially acceptable. The question is, should it be? Is that okay? Is it okay to text and walk? You know, Honolulu just banned texting and walking. Good for them. Variable reward is the main one. Okay, so if it's the same reward every time, it's not very habit-forming. Like, who here checks their GPS? You look at it once, right? It doesn't change. Okay? That's good. Okay? So it's a tool to solve a problem. I'm for that. Okay? But like, why do you keep checking your email 150 times a day? Why is that? Okay? Because it's changing each time. And, you know, Groupon and Overstock, I mean, it might be gone, you know? That's on purpose. That's all engineered in. And I'll prove it to you. Who here uses Gmail? Number of you. Yeah. Okay. Do you ever notice that when you open up your Gmail, it takes about a second and a half to 2 seconds for the new messages to populate? What do you think? Google's just slow? That's been baked in. And we know that because Tristan Harris, former Google executive, outed them on 60 Minutes and the PBS NewsHour. And he stopped working for the company because he said, this is not okay. That they're addicting people on purpose. This is the hack. You've been drawn in, okay? And their only issue is number four, investment. So who here has spent $1,000 on the new iPhone 10? Suckers. All right. So that's the question. You know, that's what we've done, and this is the hack. Confusion and conflation of pleasure with happiness. Every one of these things is about pleasure, not about happiness. And our dopamine is going great guns. Our stress is suppressing our prefrontal cortical ability to actually modulate that pleasure. And we are becoming addicted and depressed. So what can we do personally? Because like, if we can't fix it, like, what's the point? It turns out you can fix this. You actually have the capacity. And not only that, but everyone on the planet has the capacity to fix it. But you have to know what the problem is in order to solve it. Okay? Every single thing I'm going to show you now has been clinically proven to work. Evidence-based, okay, data-driven, will up your serotonin, tamp down your dopamine, lower your cortisol, or your money back. Except none of them cost anything, so don't look for a refund. And they're all things your mother told you. First, connect. And that does not mean Facebook. Facebook is connectivity, not connection. Connection means eye to eye, face to face. And the reason for that is because we have a set of neurons in the back of our head called mirror neurons. And what they're doing is they're reading the facial expressions of the person you're talking to in real time. And they are then translating that into the same emotions that the person is expressing. You know that Paul Ekman from UC Berkeley went to Papua New Guinea, showed that everybody's facial expressions all over the world are exactly the same, irrespective of language and irrespective of culture. It's baked into our DNA, and it's our method for communicating, and these mirror neurons are taking that in. And they're generating a process which we have a name for. It's called empathy. And empathy drives serotonin. Religion drives empathy, but not because of religious belief, but because of the community. There are 4,200 religions on the planet. Okay? If any of them actually like was better than the others, there'd only be one. But every single religion that there is has a meeting place, a place where you congregate together, because that's the serotonin, that's the community. In fact, the religious verbiage is the dopamine. It's the incitement. And we know that because when we started treating Parkinson's patients with L-DOPA, they have a dopamine problem in a different part of the brain called the substantia nigra, and they have motor problems. We started treating with L-DOPA in the 1970s. Many of them became compulsive gamblers or religious zealots. There's a whole literature on that. So we know the dopamine's driving that, okay? But social media generates dopamine. That Facebook like button, that's for dopamine. That's not for serotonin, okay? That's what keeps people using Facebook and why they're Facebook addicts. Now, there are plenty of data studies that show that depression and Facebook are associated. The question is it causative? And the answer is yes, it is, because we have time lag analysis data now that shows that no matter where you start in terms of your depression scale, it is lower after you've done 2 weeks of Facebook, no matter who you are. Okay? And Sherry Turkle from MIT, also a Commonwealth Club speaker not too long ago, said, coined the term alone together. That's what we are. Number two, contributes, the four C's. Contribute, okay? What kind of contribute? Not to your IRA, okay? Padding your bank account is not contributing. Lottery winners are not happy. In fact, they're very unhappy. Those who value financial success derive less contentment from that. Just look at the White House. Spending money on yourself increases your pleasure, can certainly increase your consumer pleasure, but it does nothing for your happiness. In fact, if anything, it makes it go down. Can you derive happiness from your work? That's what everybody wants to know. And the answer is yes, with two provisos. You have to see how your work can help others, and your boss has to be able to see it too. If you have that, then you can derive happiness from work. If not, then you have altruism, volunteerism, or philanthropy. Pay someone else to do it for you, which a lot of people do. Okay. Number three, cope. This guy, okay? The art of happiness. Sleep deprivation is a disaster, and we are all now sleep deprived. 35% of adults get less than 7 hours of sleep per night, and 23% are clinical insomniacs, okay? And some of them have obstructive sleep apnea. And caffeine, in order to try to stay awake, actually reduces sleep, making things worse, and ups your dopamine because it's a stimulant. Multitasking, the most famous word around now in Silicon Valley and industrial circles. Okay, turns out multitasking is a disaster. Why? Because only 2.5% of the population can actually multitask, do two things at once. Everybody else is serially unitasking. And every time you switch from one task to another, you get a cortisol bump, making things worse. Screens are the antithesis of sleep, especially for kids. Mindfulness activates the prefrontal cortex. Basically, you know how you exercise your body? You have to exercise your prefrontal cortex. And mindfulness is how you do that. So there's a real honest-to-goodness reason for doing that meditation. And exercise is as good as SSRIs at alleviating depression. Problem is getting somebody who's depressed to exercise. That's tough. And finally, cook. Okay? Only because I'm not doing this because I like Oprah, but she did put happiness in the title, so I had to put it in there. So we have this, it turns out there are three items in food that matter. One is tryptophan. Tryptophan is the precursor to serotonin, and tryptophan is the rarest amino acid. It's the hardest one to get, and it's in eggs, poultry, and a little bit of fish, okay? But that's not what processed food is. Omega-3s are anti-inflammatory. Turns out there's an inflammatory bouton around the synaptic nerve terminal in omega-3 deficient animals that goes away when you give them omega-3s because it's anti-inflammatory, anti-Alzheimer's. And finally, fructose, which depletes your serotonin, ups your dopamine, depletes your serotonin. Processed food is low tryptophan, low omega-3s, high fructose. Real food is higher tryptophan, not high, but higher. High omega-3s, low fructose. Real food works, processed food doesn't. Problem is, one third of Americans don't know how to cook, and if you don't know how to cook, you're hostage to the food industry for the rest of your life. Real food movements and high gear companies who don't change will ultimately be left in the dust, or they'll be bought up and killed by the startups will be killed by the big companies. Campbell's Soup has already broken with the Grocery Manufacturers Association over this issue. My last recommendation. Cook for yourself and have a meal with your family because it's connecting, contributing, coping, and cooking all at once. It is the answer to happiness. You want to do something, that's what you can do. With that, I will let Patty now have the floor. Thank you.
Okay. What I'm going to do, I'm not going to stand up there, and I'm going to close out the program, and then after the recording stopped, I'm going to see how fast you can answer these questions.
You bet.
I am going to
tell you. I will be fast.
Okay.
Promise.
So here we go. So it's my, this in closing, thank you very much for Dr. Robert Lustig for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as for those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the 114th year of the Commonwealth Club of Enlightened Discussion is hereby adjourned. Okay. Just so you know, did it go off? off? Okay, I'm going to ask a few of the questions. Rob, I am really am going to time you here.
Yes, I'm going to be fast.
And for he's going to be
I thought signed. I was fast, too.
You did awesome. It was great. Matt and Sarah, raise your hands. Where are you? Oh, they're out there. Matt and Sarah, my neighbors, friends, they're going to be putting, for those of you who want Rob to sign a book for you, they're going to be writing your name and putting it in the front of the book so he doesn't have to ask you how to spell your name. Goes faster. Okay. Okay, I have to pick this one because he wrote, pick me, pick me, pick me on the back. How do you say no to that? Like an oral, that's a first. I think I'm going to frame this one. Like an oral glucose tolerance test can show damage to the pancreas or perhaps fasting insulin, B cells, is there a test to see if your dopamine neurons have died and to what extent?
Ooh. There is, but it's way expensive. It's called a PET scan, it's only on a research basis. It's extraordinarily expensive, and it's not really for clinical use in this case.
So the answer is
the
yes,
answer is not at this point.
Not really.
There are different addiction scales that we use, you know, in psychiatry for determining these things, but. There's the Yale Food Addiction Scale, but there's no specific dopamine test.
Okay. We're going to try to get all these in quickly. How do stress hormones play into the story of insulin resistance?
Well, cortisol is a primary driver of insulin resistance for many specific different reasons. Number one, it grows visceral fat. Number two, it alters glucose metabolism, causes hepatic glucose output, which drives hyperinsulinemia, which then causes downregulation of the insulin receptor. And it... and it also has, you know, other negative effects on not just glucose tolerance, but you know, on catabolism, causes muscle to break down, et cetera, which all ends up overloading the liver.
Okay, what are the real life nudges or strategies you recommend for your patients and their families?
Well, the first thing. I'll just tell you, in clinic, you know, when I saw an obese kid, we had four messages, okay? And they're all evidence-based and clinically proven to work if they can do them. Number one, get every sugared beverage out of the house. Number two, eat your carbohydrate with fiber, okay? Because if you eat your carbohydrate with fiber, which is called real food, the carbohydrate wasn't for you. It was for your bacteria because the fiber prevents the absorption early on in the duodenum. So more of what you ate will go further down the intestine into the jejunum, second part of the intestine where the bacteria are. They got to eat something too. So if you ate it with fiber, it was for them, not for you. So eat your carbohydrate with fiber so it doesn't all end up in your liver. Wait 20 minutes for second portions. Let the satiety hormone, peptide YY, work. And finally, buy your screen time with activity. Okay. All clinically tested, all clinically proven to work. Okay, so the question is, do the kids do it? And the answer is, it depends on who the parent is.
What'd you have for breakfast? That should be a fast answer.
Today?
Yeah, right now.
Whitefish salad on pumpernickel.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. There was three or four different questions about, I'm going to read them really quick, but you can answer them all with one answer.
Okay.
This person wants an answer.
Okay.
Registered dietitians are not autonomous. They take orders from MDs. The only people who get their nutrition...
No, they don't.
Okay, well, just let me read it. The only person who get their nutrition info are RDs in hospitals. MDs get, 6 hours of nutrition in 4 years, 25%. Of medical school, most people get their nutrition info online or in books or from friends or personal trainers. Who is teaching?
Right.
Oh, good nutrition anyway.
It's a great question. Okay,
hang on.
It is a great question.
This one, there's a couple really similar. So
okay.
You can do them all at once.
Okay.
What's your advice for teachers working school boards and crafting rules to keep junk food out of schools? The HHFKA, I'm sorry, I don't know what that is.
Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act.
All right. Is being ignored in my district.
There's oh, yeah.
Okay, well, hang on. We're on a roll here.
Oh, yeah.
is basic nutrition education or the science behind our brains, bodies, and minds, neuroscience being taught in schools and colleges, as what part of undergrad education being taught today?
Wow.
Advice for changing policies regarding sugar in schools. People want answers to these questions.
Right. Oh, man. All right. The short answer is doctors know nothing about nutrition. They learn nothing about nutrition in medical school. I majored in nutrition in college, and then I went to medical school, and they beat it out of me. So I actually knew all this stuff back in 1975, and then I went to medical school, and basically I was told, it's all garbage, calories a calorie. And I practiced that way for 25 years until I actually started doing the research because my patients weren't getting better. And I started realizing, hey, wait a second, there's this whole literature that had never been touched. And there was actually people who had been actually deep-sixed in the research field, like John Yudkin, because of it. And so, I basically turned. And the problem is, if you believe the precept, you've believed it on faith. And that's how we got into this mess in the first place. Calories are not the issue. Problem is, dietitians learn calories. And I think the reason is because math is easy and science is hard.
Okay.
So we have a long way to go. So dietitians can either be part of the problem or they can be part of the solution. But they can't take everything at face value. They have to look at the data.
But I'm a nutritionist, not a dietitian. Well,
But the dietitians are the ones in the hospitals.
But dietitians will lose their licenses if they don't follow.
Well, so this is part of the problem.
That is the problem.
That is no question.
Yeah.
I get in trouble when I say things that the dietitians don't like, even though the dietitian at UCSF actually had me thrown out of diabetes clinic because I was telling people that they needed to reduce their carbohydrate consumption, for diabetes. And she was saying, I wrote a book about type 2 diabetes and diet. Well, now I have two.
Oh, that was good. Okay. Two questions. Well, this one's quick. Are your PowerPoint slides available anywhere online?
I'm not making this set available because I'm still giving this talk, so not yet. Okay. Eventually, this talk will be online too, but my other talks are all online.
Okay. And then
robertlustig.com.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you.
Good job, Wolfram.
Yes.
And then two questions is basically the same. They want to know what you think about stevia as an alternate sweetener, or this one, what do you think about artificial sweeteners? So that's the last
artificial
question.
Artificial sweeteners.
And then, Rob, then you're heading out.
Absolutely. Everyone wants to know about diet sweeteners. Me too. We don't have the data. There's a reasons we don't have the data. It's not because I don't know. It's because we don't have the data. There are three reasons, and I'll try to make them fast. There's something called pharmacokinetics. There's something called pharmacodynamics. They're not the same. We have all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because that tells you about acute toxicity. That's what the FDA regulates. But chronic toxicity is pharmacodynamics. The FDA does not ask for that. The food industry says, hey, compound's already on the market. Why should we do this? So they don't do it, and the NIH doesn't pay for it, because they say it's the food industry's compound, food industry's profit. So we got an FDA that doesn't ask for it, we got a food industry who won't do it, we got an NIH who won't pay for it. That's problem number one. Problem number two, you put something sweet on the tongue. Message goes, tongue to brain, sugar bolus is coming. Brain to pancreas, sugar bolus is coming, get ready to release the insulin. But then the sugar bolus never comes because it was a diet sweetener. What does the pancreas do? Does it hold on to those insulin vesicles, or does it release them anyway and you end up eating more? The early data say you eat more. In which case, then that would not be very good for weight loss. In fact, most of the studies looking at diet sweeteners say that they're associated with weight gain, and there's now a couple of studies that actually say why with the early. Number three, it's possible that the chemicals themselves of the diet sweeteners may alter the microbiome and make bad bacteria grow, which can cause leaky gut and cause insulin resistance all by themselves, having nothing to do with calories. If that's the case, then that's a real problem. But we only have animal data for that, no human data. So I don't talk about this because all the data are early and I can't prove it. So I'm very careful about not saying those things in public because the food industry would like nothing better than for me to stick my neck out so they could cut it off.
Yay.